Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're digging into some fascinating research, a multi-year program, really, that maps out the explosive digital growth happening right now in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, it's quite something. Our main source here is the 10th edition of the Economy CA 2025 report, put together by Google, Temasek, and Bain. So, you know, pretty authoritative stuff, gives us this great decade-long perspective.
Absolutely. And we'll be talking about the region, sometimes calling it A-S-E-A-N, sometimes the more common C-E-N, just so you know.
Right. Same place, different ways to say it.
So our mission for you today really is to break down this massive story. The digital economy there has smashed through the $300 billion mark in gross merchandise value, or GMV. That's huge.
Really is.
We want to pinpoint what's actually driving that, you know, the surprising things behind this success, especially in areas like commerce, finance, and how tech is being adopted.
Essentially giving you the inside track on how digital life works for, what, over 600 million people now?
Exactly. So let's just jump straight in. The macro picture, I mean, it's not just potential anymore, is it?
No, not at all. It's a genuine global digital force.
Okay, so let's unpack the scale first. That $300 billion GMV figure for 2025, it's staggering.
It is. And like you said, it's 1.5 times what they first predicted a decade back.
Which just shows how consistently the region has, well, outperformed expectations, right? They kept underestimating the sheer momentum.
Definitely. And what's interesting in this latest research is how the scope has broadened to reflect that reality. It's not just the usual CA6 anymore. Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, Vietnam.
Right.
Now it covers all 10 ASEAN nations. Mm-hmm. So you add in Brunei, Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar. We're talking about a consumer base of, 614 million people.
That context is crucial. And the historical performance, that's what really builds confidence, I think, over the last decade. What was it, 7.4 times growth in GMV?
That's right, 7.4x on GMV. But, and this is key, 11.2x growth in actual revenue.
Ah, okay, so that gap is important.
It's incredibly important. That difference between 7.4x GMV and 11.2x revenue, that tells investors something crucial.
What's the takeaway there?
It signals resilience, for one. You know, they weathered COVID, inflation, all the global headwinds. But more than that, it shows companies have figured out how to actually make money. The monetization models are working.
So it's not just empty volume, it's profitable growth.
Exactly. Profitable volume. And the foundation for all of this, as the report highlights, is just how deeply digital life has taken root.
Yeah, that shift away from the old cash is king mentality is almost complete, isn't it?
Pretty much. You've got, what, 3 out of 5 people shopping online regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And over 60% of all transactions are now digital. That's the bedrock once you hit that kind of adoption.
Then the $300 billion starts to feel, well, inevitable almost.
It becomes self-sustaining, yeah. Which leads us nicely into the specific sectors.
Right. This is where it gets really interesting. Let's talk e-commerce first. It's booming, obviously, but the revenue growth keeping pace with GMV is a good sign.
It is. Healthy growth.
But the really surprising driver, the one that jumped out at me, is video commerce.
Oh, absolutely. It's exploded.
I mean, 25% of total e-commerce GMV now. Wasn't it like under 5% just a couple of years ago?
Yeah, back in 2022, it was tiny. Now it's a quarter of the market. It's a massive shift in behavior.
Okay, but how does that work economically? The report says the average order value, the AOV, is super low, like $6 or $7.
That's right. Around $6 to $7 per order for video commerce, compared to the overall e-commerce average of, say, $11 to $13.
So half the value. How do platforms even make money on a $6 order? Doesn't the delivery cost just eat any margin?
Well, it forces incredible efficiency, obviously. They have to bundle deliveries, optimize routes like crazy. But it signals this move towards really frequent small purchases.
Impulse buys driven by what? Shoppertainment.
Exactly. Shoppertainment, but also creator trust. It's less about filling a big basket and more about this addictive, loyalty-driven buying from creators people connect with.
So it's really about the creator economy then?
Very much so. And the power is shifting too. It's not just the mega influencers anymore. The report points to niche and micro influencers having huge sway.
Because the trust is stronger.
Precisely. Especially in live formats. Apparently, something like 80% of the top-selling products get featured in live streams. You're seeing the product used, demoed by someone you, well, kind of feel you know. Particularly for things like cosmetics, fashion.
We're seeing it in action matters. Okay, that makes sense. That focus on efficiency and trust.
Cool.
How does that play out in other sectors, like food delivery?
It connects quite neatly, actually.
Mm.
Food delivery platforms, you know, they matured a lot during the pandemic lockdowns. Now, the focus is squarely on sustainability, getting to profitability.
Right, they've been squeezing costs, streamlining operations.
They have. But they're also looking beyond just delivery. They're exploring adjacent revenue streams.
Like the move into in-restaurant dining, offering vouchers, loyalty schemes.
Exactly. Using their huge customer base to offer more value to restaurants, data insights, loyalty tools.
Is there a risk they step on the toes of, like, existing restaurant software providers?
There's always competition,
Yeah.
sure, but their unique advantage is the consumer data. They can offer insights into buying patterns, peak times that local providers might not have. It's about becoming an indispensable partner, not just the delivery guy.
Got it. And what about the transport side of things, ride hailing?
That's growing too, yeah. Driven partly by diversification, things like subscription bundles, in-app ads, but also significantly by the push towards EVs.
Electric vehicles.
Yeah, especially two-wheelers. You see strong government incentives in places like Vietnam, really pushing for conversions from petrol bikes to electric.
Why the big push there? Lower emissions.
That's part of it, but it's also strategic for the platforms and drivers. Lower fuel costs mean better driver earnings, which means more driver loyalty, and ultimately a more sustainable platform business.
Interesting. And longer term, the report mentions autonomous vehicle pilots are already happening.
Yeah, AV pilots are underway in six different countries across CN. It signals, you know, potentially massive disruption down the road.
But that brings challenges, right?
Huge ones. This is where technology bumps up against social reality. The transport sector employs millions of people across ASEAN.
So job displacement is a major concern.
Absolutely. Governments and regulators face this really tricky balancing act. Embracing innovation versus managing the social and economic fallout if AVs replace large numbers of drivers too quickly. Technological readiness is one thing, societal readiness is another.
That's a really critical point, balancing progress with stability. Okay, let's shift to finance, digital financial services, or DFS, another area where trust and connectivity seem central.
Definitely. The whole DFS ecosystem is getting stronger. Lending is still the biggest revenue driver, but digital payments are like the foundational layer for everything else.
And the infrastructure progress there is quite remarkable.
It really is. Think about the QR code systems. Now, all 10 ASEAN countries have their own national unified QR system. Things like QRIS in Indonesia, Duit Now QR in Malaysia, MMQR in Myanmar.
Which makes domestic payments so much smoother.
Totally. But the really big deal is the cross-border stuff. Under this Regional Payment Connectivity Initiative, RPC, you now have eight markets with cross-border QR interoperability.
Eight. Wow. So I can travel from, say, Singapore to Thailand and just use my home country's payment app.
Essentially, yes. You scan their QR code, it connects through the system, and the payment goes through seamlessly in local currency. It's transforming regional travel and trade flows. It's a huge enabler.
That is massive. But does that seamlessness translate into trust? You mentioned trust earlier with e-commerce. How does DFS stack up?
Well, that's the interesting counterpoint.
Yeah.
Despite this amazing tech adoption, despite embedded finance being everywhere, you know, payments, loans, insurance, all bundled into the super apps,
Yeah.
the report finds that half, 50% of consumers still don't trust these digital players as much as they trust their traditional banks.
Really? Half. Why is that, do you think? If the apps are so convenient.
It seems to boil down to perceived stability, maybe longevity. Traditional banks, even if they're clunkier, are seen as these permanent, often government-backed institutions.
Whereas the digital players maybe feel a bit more transient.
Potentially, especially those focused on higher-risk areas like lending or complex insurance products. There's this perception gap around transparency, data security, maybe even regulatory oversight. They really have to work hard to build that deep bank-level trust. It's not just about convenience.
So value and transparency are key. That must be helping the digital wealth sector, though, right? Building trust slowly.
It seems so. Digital wealth platforms are definitely hitting scale. The report mentions multiple platforms now have over $1 billion in assets under management, AUM.
$1 billion AUM, that's significant scale.
It is. And they're doing it by democratizing access.
Yeah.
They're bringing in consumers from underserved communities, helping them move up that financial ladder from basic savings to microinvestments.
So it's about volume of users, not just high net worth individuals.
Exactly. Getting to $1 billion AUM by attracting maybe 1 million users, investing smaller amounts, rather than chasing a few whales, it's a different model focused on financial inclusion.
Okay, really interesting dynamics there. Now,
Yeah.
Let's pivot to the really big disruptor on the horizon, AI. How is Southeast Asia positioned for the AI wave?
Actually, incredibly well positioned, at least in terms of consumer enthusiasm. The digital population there shows some of the highest interest in AI globally.
Higher than other regions?
In some aspects, yes. For instance, 5 SEA markets rank in the global top 20 for interest in multimodal AI. You know, AI that works with images, text, voice together.
So people are already using it.
Definitely. They're using AI for discovery, finding new content or products. Three-quarters, 75% of users say AI tools have helped them discover stuff. And they expect AI to help them make decisions faster. It's a real appetite for it.
Okay, strong consumer pull. That must be attracting investment, right?
Oh, massively. AI is the big bright spot for investment right now. Over 30% of all private funding in the region over the last year went into AI-related startups.
30%? Where's that capital concentrating?
Singapore is clearly the hub. It pulled in about $1.3 billion in private AI funding and hosts the vast majority of the region's, roughly 700 active AI startups.
So consumer demand, check. Investment capital, check. Sounds like businesses should just be automating everything with AI.
Well, that's where it gets tricky. That's the logical next step you might assume if you're looking from, say, the U.S. or Europe. But there's a unique economic challenge in the CEAN region.
What's that?
It's the ROI. The return on investment for AI faces a hurdle because of, frankly, low-cost labor.
Right. You mentioned this earlier. Remind us of the wage comparison.
On average, wages in Southeast Asia are something like 5% of U.S. wages. Just 5%.
Wow. Okay. So deploying an expensive AI model.
Exactly. If you deploy a costly, sophisticated large language model to do a relatively simple task, basic customer service data entry that currently employs someone on a very low wage, the math just doesn't work out for immediate cost savings. The AI is often more expensive than the person it replaces.
So the standard Western automate and cut costs playbook doesn't apply easily?
Not directly, no. It forces a much more strategic approach. Companies there have to prioritize AI for high-value creation. Things where AI offers capabilities humans simply can't match easily, like complex fraud detection, optimizing intricate supply chains, predictive maintenance.
Stuff that adds significant value rather than just replacing cheap labor.
Precisely. And the other big focus is on workforce augmentation, using AI to make the existing low-cost workforce more productive, more efficient, rather than outright replacement. It's a more surgical application of AI.
And this brings us back to trust again, doesn't it? For consumers to really embrace AI, especially for more complex tasks.
Trust is paramount. The data shows people are generally fine with AI for everyday conveniences, like discovery. But, as you said, for higher stakes decisions, financial stuff, health advice, major purchases, most people still want a human in the loop. They want to be the ultimate decision maker.
So businesses need to be really transparent about how AI is used.
Absolutely. Transparency, data security, giving users control. It's crucial for building that confidence.
Yeah.
It echoes the lessons learned from the early days of digital finance adoption, actually.
Okay, let's zoom back out to the overall investment climate. You mentioned AI as a bright spot, but what's the broader picture for funding?
We're seeing a cautious recovery. Private funding hit around $7.7 billion recently, which is an uptick, but the type of deals being done has shifted significantly.
How so?
It's heavily skewed towards later stages now, Series C, D, E. Those late-stage deals make up something like 80% of the total funding.
80%. So investors are playing it safer.
Yeah.
Backing established players.
That's the story it tells, yeah. Less early-stage risk, more focus on companies with proven models and clearer paths to profitability. Doubling down on the winners.
And is digital financial services still the dominant sector for that funding?
Still is. DFS continues to pull in the lion's share. Around 45-50% of that lead stage capital. Investors still clearly believe in the long-term value of payments infrastructure and embedded finance in the region.
So despite the caution, there's confidence returning. What's underpinning that? The report mentioned four key enablers.
That's right. Four things giving investors confidence. First, entry valuations have become more realistic. They've kind of reset after the bubble.
Okay, better pricing.
Second, as we discussed, there's now a proven monetization model. Revenue growth is genuinely tracking GMV growth. It's not just hype anymore.
Right. Profitable growth.
Third, there's a much clearer path to profitability for many companies. Something like 80% of early stage investors now actually expect their portfolio companies to hit profitability soon.
That's a big shift in expectations.
It is. And the fourth, crucially, is dependable exit pathways.
Meaning IPOs or acquisitions.
Exactly. There's a robust pipeline now, over 150 potential IPO candidates identified across Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore primarily. That gives investors confidence they can actually get their money back with a return. Liquidity is key.
Okay, so wrapping this all up, we've seen this incredibly dynamic digital economy. Sustained double-digit growth, hitting that $300 billion mark.
Driven by really interesting, sometimes unexpected things like video commerce taking off.
And underpinned by these massive infrastructure achievements like the cross-border QR payments connecting the whole region.
Yeah, really knitting ASEAN together digitally.
All while the region navigates this complex shift towards an AI-driven intelligent economy, but doing it in its own way because of those unique economic factors.
Absolutely. You know, the first decade was really about overcoming those fundamental barriers.
Mm-hmm.
Poor connectivity, the cash culture, building basic digital literacy. They did that.
They absolutely did.
Now, the digital economy isn't just some niche sector. It's becoming a really significant part of overall GDP, supporting tens of millions of jobs. So the next decade, it feels different.
How so?
Well, the future hinges on balancing these powerful catalysts like AI speeding things up, renewed investment, hopefully more regional cooperation against the hurdles like global economic uncertainty. But the real wild card, it's government action. Regulation.
Ah, so regulation becomes the make or break factor now.
I think so. The decisive factor for this next wave of growth, getting beyond $300 billion, will likely be the choices governments make. You have this complex, fragmented regulatory landscape across 10 different countries.
Especially around tricky issues like data privacy, data localization, AI governance.
Exactly. Will that patchwork act as a major break, slowing down the cross-border progress we've seen? Or will we see greater cooperation, maybe shared frameworks through ASEA that actually unlock the region's full potential?
That's the multi-billion dollar question, isn't it?
It really is. And definitely something for you, the listener, to mull over as you watch how global digital economies evolve. Will regulation enable or inhibit this next phase for Bropian? We'll have to wait and see.